This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you today in this wonderful Saturday morning of a holiday weekend. And hopefully everybody's going to be able to get out and enjoy the day to some degree. I've been looking forward to today's show. Many of the questions that have come in have had to do with COVID-19 and various infections that we are faced with. Specifically, we're looking at the fall season and trying to deal with COVID, RSV, and the flu. So with that, our guest starting at 11:20 will be Dr. David Banik, who is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut, and he is an infectious disease specialist. He's been on our show many times and is a great resource for me in discussing the various levels of infection, especially with COVID, and giving us practical advice as to what we should be doing. So it'll be great to chat with him. If we have time, I do also want to talk to him about tick-borne illnesses as we're getting into the fall. Many of you, and many of the questions I got, pertain to my role with UConn football. So the other night, this was Thursday night, we had our initial game with North Carolina State. And unfortunately, I was called into action. And I say unfortunately because my role on the sideline is primarily as a neurotrauma specialist. And that being, if there is an injury to the nervous system, whether it be the brain, spine, peripheral nerve, could be concussion, could be a variety of things, I'm asked to intervene. And if it's especially critical, even if it's for the other team, I am available to them. And you have to understand, when we look at sports injuries, there are only two ways of dying in sports. They're cardiac, neurologic. We saw that with the Buffalo Bills this year. We've seen it with other people where they have cardiac arrest. And fortunately, we've been able to use AEDs and, again, implement an emergency action plan. So I say, unfortunately, the emergency action plan had to be triggered this week. And I've been on the sideline with UConn since 1997 when I was invited there by Dr. Anderson. And I share the duties there with my daughter, Stephanie, who's at Hartford Hospital. But so in the game, if you are watching or have heard, there's a suspected cervical spine injury on an opposing player from North Carolina State. And we could see from our end, the player was down and not moving, and there was some sense of urgency. So I indeed came over. And again, this triggers this plan, and the plan starts with immobilizing the player's neck. One person is assigned to put traction on the neck as they try to get a collar on. There's also an equipment person there with a variety of devices that lift the mask off the helmet. You don't just take the helmet off because you'll have to bend the neck. So again, there's somebody there getting the mask off, somebody putting traction on, and then cutting off the shoulder pads. So there's a way to cut through the heavy material there, cutting through while getting the player onto a board so that they are strapped on and immobilized and get them to the emergency room. So it's a series of events that get triggered based on the type of injury. My job in that role is to oversee the protocol. Their physicians were there going through the protocol, and to notify the emergency room ahead of time that we will be coming in with neurotrauma. In this case, Hartford Hospital is only 10 minutes from Rentschler Field, and that is where we went. And that triggered the trauma team to get ready. And I have to really take my hat off to the people at Hartford Hospital and the emergency department who did a wonderful job. When we got there, they were ready. There are two physicians there. There's a pharmacist there. You know, they're ready for any type of trauma, you know, particularly whether it's a gunshot, motor vehicle accident. So we call ahead to let them know what we're thinking so they could plan and have the CT scanner, one of the scanners. They have two scanners in the emergency department, so they have one scanner ready so that we're not waiting to get the player on. Fortunately, this ended up being an injury where his symptoms did eventually resolve, and he was discharged safely the following day. In the case of neurotrauma, it's pretty standard to keep the patient either overnight or for a period, usually a minimum of 12 hours, to see what develops, because you can have injury and then symptoms develop later on. So we wanted to be sure. But again, I want to thank the folks at Hartford Hospital and at East Hartford Ambulance Emergency Services did a phenomenal job. This day in medicine, September 2nd, 1952, Dr. Floyd John Lewis performed the first cardiac surgery using deep freezing techniques. And he did this on a five-year-old girl where he repaired an atrial septal defect at the University of Minnesota. Now, why was this momentous? First of all, I didn't know it was done in 1952. That's a long time ago for this type of procedure. And what he did was he repaired basically a hole in the heart of a child between the two atria, the upper chambers of the heart. And the reason why it's amazing is because it's something we still do, right? So we are now really 70 years later doing the same thing with what we call therapeutic hypothermia. And when he, after he did that procedure in 1952, he proceeded to do 60 similar procedures successfully over the next 3 years. So very interesting, because he was really a pioneer in this. And once it worked, that triggered this succession of lives saved in young children, and something we do fairly routinely now. But I want to talk a little bit about hypothermia, and we use it a lot now, again, with cardiac procedures, and the idea is to use it as a protective strategy for the brain and vital organs, not just with heart surgery, but so someone who has had a serious heart event, we would cool them to 34 degrees centigrade, while waiting for the heart to kick in and start working normally and recover. So typically we do it for a period of 24 hours in that acute setting so that it gives the brain a chance to rest. So it's very interesting from that standpoint that we still do that. Normal body temperature being 37 degrees for those of you who don't think in terms of centigrade, which is many of us. So you cool to 34 degrees and then rewarm the patient gradually, and hopefully neurologic function resumes at that point. A lot going on in the field of infectious disease, and we're going to have a detailed discussion with Dr. Banik. I think one of the things that everybody questions is masks. First of all, are masks effective? There was an article in published. There was a Cochrane report published, and when they looked at the entirety of the pandemic, they felt that masks did not make a difference overall in controlling the pandemic. I think that that could be somewhat misleading, from the standpoint that when you look at the entirety And looking at it retrospectively, what you're looking at here are a variety of masks. When were they using them? How were they using them? Because we know now that the N95 or the KN95 mask is the most effective. And you have to think of the masks as a personal device, right? It's a device you use for personal protection. So the question becomes, okay, do I wear a mask? When do I wear a mask? And what type of mask? Well, what type of mask is pretty easy, and they're pretty cheaply. You get an N95 or a KN95. The numbers are going up. You've heard that on the report just prior to this program, and we know that the number of hospitalizations in Connecticut is going up. We've seen it in our own clinic where we have physicians and nurses testing positive. And to be honest with you, I still wear a mask when I'm with a patient. And now I've asked all patients to wear a mask when they're in the exam room. And guess what? No one has even mildly resisted that idea. I'm not saying it's a mandate, but I think it's for their own safety because, hey, we have these outbreaks even in medical clinics. So I think when you're in a medical facility, I don't care if you're visiting somebody or whatever, put a mask on. Maybe we could get away from mandates by people using common sense. So when you're in a closed area, you're going to be on an airplane. And some people say they use the mask at the various choke points that I've talked about in the past, such as when going through TSA or embarking on the plane or disembarking from the plane. Great, but might be worth keeping the darn thing on. It's not that uncomfortable with an appropriate mask. So I think we have to start thinking that way again is, okay, am I using the mask? Do I keep one in my back pocket? Again, as a point of there is no question that as a device for personal protection against COVID, the mask is effective. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik, from the Infectious Disease Department at the University of Connecticut. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. As always, we're taking your questions via the internet, by email. If you just shoot me an email at info@alessimd.com. We've had several questions, and we'll try to answer those as we go through our interview with Dr. David Banik, who will be with us for the remainder of this program. David, welcome back to the show.
All right, thank you for having me on.
David, let me just start. We were just talking about masks before you came on. What are you doing as far as masks now? I mean, I started wearing a mask around all my patients, and I've asked patients to wear a mask, especially if I'm with them for a prolonged period of time. We're starting to see more cases, whether it be in the clinic and families, kids going back to school, the numbers are up. What do you advise?
Well, you know, I think masking decisions are going to be a bit individualized. You know, as you mentioned, we are seeing a bit of an uptick in COVID. We are seeing more cases in the community. You know, I think individuals are making their own decisions about masks and how they're going to protect themselves. And a lot of that's going to be based on their own risk, their risk for a serious illness, based on comorbidities, age. You know, in healthcare facilities, you know, I don't think mandates have been kind of reinstated in most places. We may see that in the future if we see an uptick. You know, I use masks with certainly with my higher risk patients when I'm seeing them in the clinic, in the office. But I think, you know, this is going to evolve over the next few months, and, you know, we'll have to see where things go with COVID rates.
Okay. Well, let's get to that. Let's talk a little bit about COVID rates and the new variants. We keep hearing about BA286, but we still have EG5, FL151. Tell us about it. What's going on, and which way are we headed here?
Sure. So, you know, I think at this point we're seeing a mix of some different variants that are circulating. You know, we're seeing some of these variants that may be a little bit more likely to infect individuals who have been previously infected and previously vaccinated, particularly if they've been vaccinated with earlier versions of the vaccine. So we are seeing some different circulating variants, a little difficult to predict what's going to be the predominant variant, if we're going to see one in the winter months up ahead. But, you know, I think regardless of which variants are circulating, they're all Omicron derivatives. You know, we have reasonable confidence that these vaccines are still going to provide protection against severe illness, and that's really going to be critical moving into the coming months.
Okay, let's talk about vaccines. So someone like myself who's been vaccinated, got all the boosters, do I have any protection right now at all? I mean, my last booster, I guess, was like January or something of that nature back then with the latest booster. Does my previous booster protect me against any of these variants now?
So, you know, I suspect that these boosters, particularly the more recent ones that are targeting Omicron, and those have been available now for the last year and a half or so, you know, they do provide protection against the currently circulating variants. You know, I think over time, you know, the protection from vaccines as well as prior infections does wane. So that's why it's going to be important moving into the coming season that those individuals, particularly those at highest risk, do get a booster vaccine. You know, the updated booster vaccine is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be adjusted based on the XBB.1.5 variant that was circulating last spring and winter. So I think, you know, it's going to be critical moving into the coming winter that those at highest risk, you know, consider vaccination as a boost to protect themselves moving into the winter season.
Should everybody get the booster, or are you saying only those at risk, the people over 65 and people with other medical conditions, or are you thinking everybody should get the booster?
So I think the recommendation from CDC, the official recommendation hasn't come out yet. What's anticipated is that it's going to be recommended for all individuals, although that hasn't been officially put forth yet. You know, I think, you know, when it comes to vaccination, you know, really the most important are the highest risk individuals. So older individuals, you know, older than 60, medical comorbidities, immunocompromised, you know, those are really who vaccine is most critical for. But I do think that younger populations, you know, can benefit from reduction of severe illness. But the magnitude of that benefit may not be as high as someone who's in that higher risk group.
I just had a mask question come in from Tom. Here's one. His son wears a cloth mask at work because he finds the KN95 to be too uncomfortable. Is he getting any protection by wearing a cloth mask?
You know, I think what we've learned is that the different quality masks provide different levels of protection. You know, the KN95s, the N95s are the highest. Next would be those surgical masks. And then the cloth masks, you know, I think some of it does depend on the quality of the cloth mask. But, you know, I really don't think that those provide significant protection. You know, if someone really is looking to protect themselves, the higher quality masks are going to be, you know, more beneficial than the cloth mask.
And, you know, just a message out to Tom. There are so many K95s and KN95s available. You just have to find the right one. And they're on Amazon. They're all the same quality, but there's so many different fits and level of comfort. I would recommend getting to that. Getting back to how severe do you think this outbreak is going to be coming up in the fall compared to what we have dealt with in previous years?
So, you know, it's always difficult to predict that. I think, you know, some things to think about, you know, the Omicron lineage does seem to be associated with less severe illness. You know, of course, that's not to say that, you know, some individuals do get very sick. I mean, we have patients right now in the hospital with COVID. I think we will see some impact on the community. I think the degree of impact will probably be based on which variants are predominant. How much of the population gets vaccinated, particularly the high-risk group that's at risk for hospitalizations and, unfortunately, mortality. And also, you know, sort of the match between the vaccine and the predominant variant. So, you know, a lot of variables coming into play when we think about how severe this season is going to be. But, you know, I think it's always best to be prepared. And, you know, the things you can do right now, vaccination, and then for those highest risk individuals, you know, additional measures like masking in higher risk situations.
Great. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik. We're talking about COVID. We're going to get to RSV and the flu as well. If you have questions, just email me right over here at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. My guest today is Dr. David Banik, and he is Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Connecticut. He is an infectious disease specialist and a great resource for our program. David, let's get back to the COVID vaccine. When will it be available, the new booster? I heard people are saying September 12th. Is that still what we're expecting?
So I think we may be looking a little bit later in September. The ACIP, which is the advisory group to CDC, is meeting in the second week in September. And at that point, it's expected the final recommendations will come out. And then the vaccine should be available relatively shortly thereafter. So I'm thinking probably later in September is when we'll start to see vaccine availability in pharmacies and clinics.
I had a question previously from Paul, and it was about, it was a few weeks ago, actually, and it was about FDA approval for the COVID vaccine. And I guess I'm not sure how that all works. I know we had emergency use, but now with a new vaccine coming every year, does it go through the same lengthy approval process? Because I would think that by the time it gets approved, we're on to the next vaccine. How does that work?
So that's a great question. Yeah, earlier on with the vaccines and you know, some of the medications and therapies, the approval was through that emergency use authorization. And that was an expedited approval to allow these therapeutics and vaccines to become available quickly. More recently, the medications and now the vaccines are going to go through the formalized FDA approval process, including this booster will be through the more formalized process. So that does take a little bit longer. Fortunately, we can use similar strategies like we used for the flu vaccine every year to move COVID vaccines forward and make them available quicker than a more like arduous process. But these will be available through the full FDA approval process moving forward.
So when it comes out sometime in this month, it will be FDA approved.
Yes, that's the plan for these current boosters to go through that that formal process. And things will be finalized hopefully mid September. I don't want to give anyone a false timeline on that, but that's what's anticipated. In the next few weeks.
How will the vaccine be distributed? Are we going to the local pharmacies again? Are there going to be clinics at the hospital? What are we doing?
I think that's going to be an important change. Before vaccines and testing was all sort of centralized to, vaccine sites and centralized testing at like drive-through testing. But now we're moving into a phase of COVID where this is going to be decentralized. So, for instance, at UConn Health, we're going to have vaccine available at our primary care clinics, some of our specialty clinics, as opposed to requiring patients to go to a specific centralized location. I think other health centers are going to be doing the same kind of process. So look to see if your primary care doctor or your physician, clinician that you're seeing routinely is going to have vaccine available because they very well may moving forward. So a little bit of a different situation than what we've seen with previous vaccine offerings.
Absolutely, because we would just send people over to CVS or to Walgreens to get it. So that is going to be a big change. Will it still be available at those places?
Yeah, no, I definitely anticipate that retail pharmacies will be a big resource for vaccines as well. So if that's how you've gotten your vaccine in the past, by all means, that should be available to you in the coming fall and winter.
Who's going to pay for it?
Good question. So that's another change. I think these vaccines are going to be now shifted into more the routine, vaccines that are administered for, flu, other conditions. And, they're going to be available with insurance coverage. And, there will be support programs available to pay for folks who don't have insurance. Those kinds of programs are out there, but it won't be like a universally funded vaccine through the government.
Do you think it'll be a situation where, you get the vaccine and you get a bill?
I hope not. I think, it'll be similar to other vaccines. So generally, when people go for their flu vaccine, they aren't.
Sure.
They it first gets pushed to an insurance for approval and, generally they're covered. So I think that'll be the type of process like what people have had for previous like flu vaccines and other routine vaccines.
And I have read that Medicare and Medicaid will pay for them. So at least that population will have it addressed. Let me move on because we had another question about RSV. A lot of people, this is kind of new to them over the course of the past year, respiratory syncytial virus. Can we talk a little bit about what it is and who should be vaccinated now that we have a vaccine?
Sure. So RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus, this is a virus that's been with us for a very long time. You know, it's, in the last couple of years, it's gotten a little bit more attention. It can cause infection in individuals of all ages, but tends to cause more severe infections in two groups, young children and older individuals. Anyone in between those groups tends to get a mild illness and usually recovers relatively easily. A few things that have changed recently, and may recall a year ago or so, there was a significant RSV a surge among pediatrics. The pediatric hospitals were seeing a big uptick in pediatric hospitalizations from RSV. So RSV was circulating at a pretty high rate. You know, the other important change this year is that we know we have a vaccine that's FDA approved for RSV, and you know that's going to be a key tool to protect those individuals at the older end of the spectrum. So it's going to be available to individuals over age 60 to provide protection, because that's really the group that's at highest risk for hospitalizations and severe illness.
Will it be readily available, or is this going to be something that's in limited supply?
So I anticipate it'll be readily available. Unfortunately, there have been some delays. You know, there was a hope that it would be readily available by early September. And, you know, from what I'm hearing, even though it's gone through the full the FDA approval and the CDC has made official recommendations and the vaccine is becoming distributed, it hasn't been as widely available yet, though I anticipate in the coming weeks we'll see more and more RSV vaccine availability. We're working to obtain it at UConn, and other health centers throughout Connecticut are looking to do the same. So I think between retail pharmacies and medical clinics, this vaccine will become increasingly available in the coming weeks.
Is it going to be similar distribution? So you'd go to your primary care doctor and get your COVID vaccination as well as the RSV vaccination?
Yeah, I'm anticipating that'll be the case. It'll be a mix of retail pharmacies that'll be offering it, plus medical clinics. I don't know if as many medical clinics are going to have access to it as things like the flu vaccine, which, you know, is very widely distributed already. Sure. So that may be a limiting factor, but it'll be out there in the community and in medical clinics and retail pharmacies.
Okay. Let's move on. The flu, something we talk about every year. What are we expecting in terms of the flu now?
So, you know, I think we've seen some interesting trends over the last few years since the pandemic began in terms of flu. You know, we saw a milder flu season during the early years of the pandemic, a little bit more last year. So a little hard to predict what to expect for this year. I think there is an expectation that we'll see flu activity here in Connecticut in the winter months. You know, we're thinking, you know, usually around November through March, although there's some variability year to year. So I do expect there'll be flu activity. You know, we have a vaccine that's already available to protect against the flu. It's FDA approved and already available at retail pharmacies and medical clinics. So, I think that's going to be the key measure to protect against flu into the coming months. And, I'm optimistic that we'll see a reasonable flu season, but you never know. It could be one of those bad years. A lot of it depends on vaccine and circulating strain matches and, you know, some other factors that we don't have a handle on just yet.
Should everybody get the flu vaccine, or again, is it mostly for people at risk?
Yeah, the CDC recommendation is for everyone to get the vaccine. You know, I think the flu vaccine does provide good protection against flu for all age groups. You know, we still have the higher risk groups like older individuals, folks with medical comorbidities who are at highest risk for severe infection, and they really benefit probably the most from vaccine. But, you know, I encourage individuals of all ages to get the flu vaccine. It's, you know, been around for a long time. The vaccine effectiveness, has good data. So I think, it's a vaccine that everyone should be going out and getting moving into the winter.
Can and should somebody get all three at the same visit, or should you spread them out? What do we know?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Yeah, we know a little bit about this. So we do know that co-administration of the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine, now we've had that for a couple of years. That seems to be safe, and no concerns about effectiveness of getting those two vaccines at the same time. You know, the RSV vaccine, this is the first year that we're offering it. So we don't have the data necessarily to support that co-administration with an RSV vaccine plus a flu vaccine or a COVID vaccine at the same time, if there's going to be any concerns about that. There right now isn't any suspicion that there will be concerns, but we just don't have the data. So that's the one combination that folks may want to have a little bit of a gap between the two. We don't anticipate that there's going to be safety issues, but again, something that we're still going to need to collect data on this coming season.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going to have to wait a little bit for the RSV vaccine anyhow, so you're probably better off getting COVID and flu done first, the way this lays out logistically.
Yeah, I think we'll just have to see what's available. A little bit difficult to predict at this moment, but I think in the next few weeks we'll have a good sense as to the timeline for availability for all three. But the flu vaccine already available accessible.
So in summing it up, flu vaccine for everybody, RSV for those only at risk, and COVID only at risk or a little more liberal than that?
Yeah, no, I think, again, the COVID recommendation, we're still waiting for the official recommendation from CDC. I anticipate it'll be recommended for all individuals. Like I said, there's some benefit for individuals in all age groups, but the most benefit is going to be among those with risk factors for severe infection, like older individuals and individuals with medical comorbidities.
And as always, control your risk factors where they can be controlled, right? I mean, blood sugars. Exercise.
That's a critical message. Yeah, no, I think that is a really important message. You know, we have the tools like vaccines and masks that help prevent severe infections, but, you know, we have to be attention to, taking care of those medical comorbidities and, doing what we can to stay healthy as well outside of, in addition to these other specific measures.
And if you're sick, just stay home, okay? I mean, why spread it? I know people want to get to parties and things like that, but we'd need a little bit of common sense on this. I want to move on. Something that it's always on our minds here in Connecticut are tick-borne diseases, especially now we get into fall. People want to get out and hike. The weather's a little bit cooler. People want to play golf. They're going to be out there where the ticks live. Can we talk a little bit about that? What are we expecting this year? And maybe talk about the various tick-borne illnesses we need to be concerned about.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a great topic. So, there's three main tick-borne infections that we see here in Connecticut. We see Lyme disease, we see babesiosis and anaplasmosis, and they're all carried by the same tick that is sort of endemic here in Connecticut, the deer tick. This past summer, we've actually seen an increase in tick-borne infections. Maybe related to having a milder winter, a little bit more, in terms of ticks out in the environment. So I think they need to be on the radar. Unfortunately, we've had patients that were hospitalized with all three of those infections at various times throughout the summer. So they can be severe. They're treatable, and there's a lot of prevention out there that can really prevent these infections from happening. So, I think those are some of the key messages. Doing things like after being out in the woods, coming inside, taking off your clothes, laundering them, doing tick checks and removing any ticks quickly can help prevent attachment and infection. Tick repellents are a really important tool. So if you're going to be going out in the woods, spray yourself with some tick repellent. That can really make a big difference in terms of preventing these kinds of tick-borne infections. But, like I said, they've been on the rise this past summer, we still tend to see them moving into the fall months, like September and October. So, doing what you can to protect yourself from tick infections is really critical. And then, of course, if you do develop symptoms, and the symptoms can range from the classic bullseye rash that we think about with Lyme disease, but also some of these other infections can cause kind of flu-like symptoms. So if you do, have these kinds of symptoms, getting checked out, mentioning to your clinician that you had you've been out in the woods, you had tick exposure, is really important in deciding what kind of testing and treatment might be appropriate for you.
Now, here's the problem. We just mentioned, again, flu-like symptoms. So people are getting symptoms. It could be COVID, could be flu, could be RSV, could be a tick-borne illness. Is there a way people can kind of practically differentiate in some way?
So there's a few things. So, with these respiratory infections like COVID, RSV, they really present with fever, but also some associated respiratory symptoms. So thinking about fever plus sore throat, congestion, cough, those kinds of symptoms would point you more towards one of those types of infections. Whereas The tick infections would not really present with those kinds of respiratory symptoms. Really fever, achiness, sore muscles and joints, those kinds of things. We can see them with tick infections as well. So, I think we have the diagnostic testing that's available. So if you have a fever, you don't really have an explanation, you're not feeling well, by all means, going to see your doctor to help kind of sort some of that out. It would be the next step. We have testing available for COVID at home as well. So that might be a good starting point, especially if you're having respiratory symptoms, to start with a home test. Important to mention that these home tests do reliably detect these circulating variants at the same rate as they've detected previous variants. So that is an important thing for folks to know. But I think if there's question, given the conundrum, I think getting checked out is the next step, and getting a diagnosis and the appropriate treatment.
Symptoms between Lyme disease, babesiosis, anaplasmosis, I almost said ehrlichiosis, but anaplasmosis. Big difference in symptoms as they present. How do you differentiate those?
So there's some differences in terms of symptoms. Anaplasma and babesia tend to present with more kind of the flu-like symptoms, fevers, achiness. Whereas Lyme disease, the most common is really that bullseye skin rash is the most common way that we see Lyme disease. Although in some situations you can get some achiness and milder symptoms associated with that too. But those are the big ones. And then on blood testing, we can differentiate characteristics of the three different infections. And we can also test specifically for all three of those. So, the symptoms can overlap. The babesia and anaplasma tend to be more with the flu-like symptoms. But regardless if you're not feeling well, reaching out to your clinician to do the appropriate testing can help make a clearer diagnosis.
And as always, early treatment is best in getting on it with doxycycline really makes a difference to not just sit around and say, let's see how it develops, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when it comes to these tick infections, earlier treatment is key to preventing progression of illness, particularly, the patients that we see in the hospital with these infections tend to be on the older side or have other medical conditions. So if you're in that group, by all means, trying to get an answer and on the right treatment early is important.
David, in the last few minutes, you sent me the CDC health advisory this morning that I wasn't familiar with Vibrio vulnificus. The only Vibrio I remember is cholera, because I saw so much of it in Haiti. So can you talk a little bit about this new outbreak and the CDC health advisory?
Sure. So Vibrio, this has gotten a lot of attention here in Connecticut. In fact, we've had a few cases that have made the news of really severe Vibrio infections. So this is an infection caused by bacteria that live in water environments. So either brackish waters or like waters of salt water and sort of combined sources, but also in the ocean. So I think the ones in Connecticut have been linked to Long Island Sound, where people have had exposure to seawater and have subsequently gotten very sick. But this is not a new bacteria. It's something we've known about for a long time, but can cause severe infections in folks after being out in the ocean or in Long Island Sound in these situations, particularly if they have a skin break or a wound that becomes infected. It can lead to a really very severe infection that needs to be treated urgently. So, I think the key message for this one is that, if you do develop symptoms of a skin infection, a wound infection, and have recently been in the ocean, you really need to get that checked out and get started on treatment right away, and make sure that you mention that you were recently in the ocean or in some sort of water source to your treating clinician. So because that'll impact the decisions about antibiotics. I mean, this bacteria is very treatable in the earlier stage with the appropriate antibiotics, but unfortunately, if it gets delayed, can progress to, we call sepsis and very severe infection and hospitalization. So it's gotten a lot of attention. It's, in the grand scheme of things, it's quite uncommon, but it can happen, here in Connecticut. So if you're going to be exposed to the ocean, Long Island Sound, and then subsequently develop sickness, please get checked out and make sure you mention that water exposure when you're getting evaluated.
But it's typically someone who has an open wound getting into the water?
That's most common, that we see a wound that becomes infected. Another way that folks can get infected is by ingesting contaminated seafood, so like oysters and other shellfish that have been contaminated. As well, you can get severe gastrointestinal illness that can make people sick. But, you know, skin and wound infections are the big thing to look out for. If you notice, anything very suspicious going on with the skin or wound area after you haven't been in the ocean, you know, you really need to get that checked out.
David, thank you. Thank you for your time. Sure. It's been a long. We took a lot of your time today, and I know you're busy, but thank you. It's always helpful to have you on and review this and answer the many questions that come in. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Leslie. I'm happy to join anytime.
Well, we're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Well, thank you all for listening. It's been a great show with Dr. David Banik, and I thank him for his time. Many thanks to Joey Burgoyne, who's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, I taped an interview with Dr. Lauren Gainey. You're going to find this fascinating. Dr. Gainey is a foot and ankle surgeon at the University of Connecticut, and she recently created an ankle replacement with a 3D printer. So all you folks who listen to TAB may want to listen to this, because this is personalized medicine, right? It's an ankle replacement. It's a new ankle that's just made for that particular person. So we're going to talk to her all about how that was done over at UConn Health. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast and download it at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.